This episode of the Deck Tees Podcast is brought to you by Gathering Magic and CoolStuffInc.com. Become a part of their customer rewards program when you make any purchase and receive discounts on all future orders. That is CoolStuffInc.com. Welcome to episode 104 of the Deck Tees Podcast. I am your host, Aaron Campbell. My guest today is affectionately referred to as P. Sully. You can find him most weekends in the coverage booth on the Star City Games Open Series. He is Patrick Sullivan. Hello.
Hello, Aaron. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to come on. This is a big thrill for me.
Oh, absolutely. No, this is on my short list of podcasts to be on. In fact, actually, it was really the only one, but I guess besides my own with Cedric, so it's a list of two.
You actually bring up a really good point. You actually asked to come on my show. I didn't have to pursue you.
Well, I appreciate the work that you do. I think the podcast is done very professionally. I respect you a lot as an interviewer, and so I did reach out to you, and you were gracious enough to have me on the show, so here we are.
Yeah, I was really surprised. I still have that modesty. Like, you know who I am? Like, you want to be on my own? Okay. And it took me a minute to go, Patrick Sullivan wants to be on my show? Whatever. And then once it sunk in, I was like, of course, you can come on. So I'm very happy to have you here.
Well, excellent.
So the first thing I want to talk about is something a lot of us experienced this past weekend was pre-releases. Now, did you pre-release at all?
I did. My friends dragged me up to a store up in Orange County, so I was able to play in pre-release. I don't even know the name of the store, unfortunately. Someplace in Huntington Beach, but it was the first pre-release I played in, I think, since Theros, I want to say.
Okay. Okay. And how did it go?
It went well. I went 4-0. That's not true. I'm sorry. I did play in the M15 pre-release, and then okay. Theros was the one before that. But I did go undefeated, so successful as far as that goes. Plus, the store had a dog, so I got to spend most of my time in between rounds hanging out with a dog. So it was a really good pre-release.
So you're a dog person?
I am. I'm a big animal person.
Okay. See, I'm an animal person, but I admit I don't really like dogs. I know.
I grew up with dogs and cats as well, so those are the two animals I default to. But I also grew up in farm country, so, you know, cows, whatever, everything goes, basically. So
really?
Yes. So I was very happy that the store had a dog. He was very friendly. So in between rounds, I got to just kind of hang out with a dog, which was really nice for me because I didn't know very many people at the store. So it kept me occupied.
Are you shy? Are you a shy person?
No, I'm very extroverted. But okay. At Magic tournaments now, there's enough, oh my God, are you Patrick Sullivan kind of stuff that makes me really uncomfortable in social settings. Mm-hmm. And so getting to blend in the background now is something I value quite a bit. So if people come up to me or it seems like the conversation is just kind of about random stuff, that's totally cool. But I'm at a point now where I'm not looking to go out and engage in that myself.
I've also kind of experienced that a little bit where people at my local game store only want to talk about the show, where mm-hmm. I will go to FNM or I will go to a game day and somebody will be like, so who's going to be on this week? What are you going to talk about? Who's next? I'm like, I'm really just here to play. Like, I'm really not looking to talk about the show. And I always feel like a little bit of a jerk for having to turn people down or say, I kind of feel like how celebrities are like, no pictures, please. You know, that's kind of what it feels like. You know, you're just there to play Magic, you know?
I'm not trying, you know, I was there once upon a time, and everyone that I ever interacted with in that capacity was super cool to me. So I'm not trying to shove it aside like it doesn't matter, mm-hmm. but it is something where, you know, it has kind of changed the way that I approach tournaments or social gaming situations where I don't know a lot of people and I'm trying to get acclimated to the environment. I'm a lot more introverted than I used to be now, you know, compared to a couple of years ago, certainly.
Sure, I can certainly relate to that. So what clan did you choose?
Well, I was Mardu. I like to beat down.
Oh.
This unfortunately marks the third consecutive pre-release where I did not play the color or colors in the guild pack that I selected.
Really?
So I was red in the Theros pre-release, did not end up playing red in my sealed pool. I was red in the M15 pre-release, did not end up playing red in my sealed pool. And then I was Mardu and ended up playing Azban. I believe it's pronounced instead. So mm-hmm. I had a pretty solid white, green, black deck, nothing too noteworthy, you know, an end hostilities and an utter end and some big stuff. I mean, the deck was totally fine and I was able to defeat the opposition with it.
Mm-hmm. Now, an interesting topic came up on Twitter the other day about people who view pre-releases as competitive events, and more importantly, stores that dish out these huge payouts that sort of promote people or encourage people to be a bit more spiky at pre-releases. And I'm sort of the mindset that pre-releases should be welcoming to new players and that they should be a bit more casual. And I'm always surprised at people who feel the opposite, that they go into them like, I'm going to crush. And I see stories of people winning cases at their pre-releases. And what are your thoughts on that? Like, do you think they should be treated like that, or should they be a bit more laid back?
The pre-releases that I played in back in Jersey many years ago, they were all super tournament focused. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the prizes that are a case, the things you're describing. I think ultimately the stores need to cater to their player base while erring on the side of people are going to be coming into the store for the first time. Mm-hmm. So I think stores need to use their discretion in terms of, you know, my player base is fairly casual. We should make sure the payouts are fairly flat. Or I have a very competitive player base at my store. Maybe the entrance fee should be higher and the prize is more top heavy, wherever the case may be. But I do think that stores or TOs, whoever, do need to err on the side of making sure that the environment is, you know, good and catering to new players, not just with the prize support, but just the environment as a whole. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle. So, you know, I think that there's room for flexibility, but people lose sight of the fact that there's going to be people playing in their first tournaments or their first really big sanctioned event. And the experience needs to be good for that class of player as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm really lucky in Milwaukee that we have 3 or 4 stores, and each of them sort of have established themselves as being like the casual pre-release store, the serious pre-release store, and people can sort of adjust, you know, where they go based on that. But I always feel bad for people that have like a store, and, you know, let's say that store decides to be super competitive and they don't want to be, they don't have much of a choice, and they might feel, you know, a bit intimidated and not go there. Or the opposite, you know, somebody might be feeling a little spiky and their one local store decides to be casual and they don't get a choice. So I'm reminded of how lucky I am that I have all these different stores to choose from depending on what I want.
San Diego has a lot of the same element. The store that's closest to me is a place called Sky High Comics, which is in a town called San Marcos, about 15 minutes away from me. Mm-hmm. And the store is very casual. I mean, they run standard tournaments and drafts and FNN and all that, but it's not a very competitive player base. They're very inviting and accepting of new players. And a lot of the players there I've known for a very long time. So if I'm just kind of looking to just shoot the shit and play some games in a low-pressure environment, that's my place. And then there's a store further down, closer to downtown San Diego in Mira Mesa. It's changed its name a couple times, but it's, I think it's called San Diego Games and Comics, but that's a much larger store. They host PTQs in the area, and their pre-releases are – they're not super spiky, but it's definitely – they're bigger. There's more prizes at stake. There's more of an edge to it. So, mm-hmm. you know, you can kind of customize the experience you're looking for. But for me, pre-releases are a really valuable opportunity to just like relax and play some games, and whoever wins, whoever loses, who cares? You know, that kind of atmosphere.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely – more biased towards playing in the casual stores. And that was the case even when I was a super competitive, you know, playing in PTs and GPs all the time and all that kind of stuff. I still wanted my pre-releases to just be an opportunity to relax and hang out and experience the new cards.
Yeah, I'm always a little worried about people who feel they have to be on all the time, where I find the pre-releases to be refreshing because I am sort of very competitive in everything else that I do, where if I go to a trial, I want to win. If I go to a PTQ, I want to win. That's sort of my time off, where it's like I get that one weekend every 3 months where I'm not in that mindset and I'm not going to tilt and it's not the end of the world. And I can't imagine having everything you do be like that, you know, not you personally, but anybody.
Right. You need to be able to have the on-off switch with certain things. But I know that when I was coming up and starting to play in, you know, states and regional tournaments, for me, part of getting better was taking a very professional mindset to every match. You know, mm-hmm. 0-1 bracket of FNM, it's still trying to figure out what the right play is. So I can appreciate people who are in that particular spot in their competitive arc. But I hope for most people it's just a phase they kind of get over quickly rather than a permanent way with which they engage in the game.
Sure. So you brought up something very interesting that I want to talk about. So I want to talk about your past and your childhood. You indicated you were a farm boy. Did I hear that right?
Well, I grew up in a town called Hillsborough, New Jersey, mm-hmm. which when I was growing up was about 25,000 people living in the town. So not the smallest town or whatever, but landmass size very large, a lot of farms. There's a cornfield abutting my parents' backyard. I mean, it's not, you know, I wasn't wearing overalls or whatever, but it was pretty rural, I would say. But it was always a town that had a pretty pretty good gaming scene and public schools that were surprisingly forward-thinking and supportive when it came to things like Dungeons and Dragons and things like Magic. You know, my middle school had an after-school Magic club and an after-school Dungeons and Dragons club with a teacher supervising. This is way ahead of the time for, you know, 1993, 1994, 1995. So yeah. I was very fortunate in some respects, even though it wasn't, you know, the most urban upbringing.
Mm-hmm. New Jersey. You don't strike me as being obviously from New Jersey.
I'm not exactly sure what that's supposed to imply.
You meet somebody like, I believe Fabiano is from New Jersey, correct?
Yes.
And that's somebody where you look at him and you know he's from Jersey. I love him, but just, you know what I'm saying? He's very Jerseylicious. And
he's very Northern Jersey and he's very Italian Jersey, which is a different thing. Okay. He grew up in Sopranos territory. In fact, I'm not even kidding. I'm not saying he's not mobbed up or whatever, but you know, the town where Anthony's uncle, Junior Soprano, mm-hmm. lives in the show, that's Gerard's hometown.
Wow.
So, I mean, he's very Northern Jersey. I grew up in Central Jersey, which is much closer to Rutgers and Princeton University. Okay. And it's very rural, you know, relatively speaking. So right. It's a different element, although I only grew up, you know, half an hour or 40 minutes from where Gerard lives. It's a small state, but inside of that, there's definitely a bunch of different cultures and communities.
I've only been to New Jersey once in my life. I was there for a Pokemon tournament when I played the Pokemon card game, and a friend and I, we took a road trip out to New Jersey, and I have to say, it was a pretty terrible experience. We found that everybody was really mean to us. The only people that were nice to us were the out-of-towners, but I remember we couldn't make sense of your freeway system. It was a maze. And
it's,
I remember,
really bad.
It is. And I remember at one point we asked a cop for help, and the cop actually looked at us and was like, if you don't know where you're going, I can't really help you. And I'm like, yeah. But that's your job, though. You're a cop. And and the best part about the trip to New Jersey, I will never forget this. So we were staying at a Hampton Inn, and across the street from the hotel, there was a Chi-Chi's, if you remember Chi-Chi's restaurant.
Yep.
Okay. And so we were eating a Chi-Chi's, and it was about 9:30 p.m. And as we're finishing our dinner, we're hearing this boom, 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 boom. And we're like, bass. And we're like, where's bass coming from? And we leave the Chi-Chi's, and there's a line full of people outside of the Chi-Chi's, and they're all really like sassily dressed. And we're like, what's this line for? And we ask the maitre d' or the host or whatever, and he goes, oh, after 10 p.m., this turns into Club Chi-Chi's.
Oh,
and I'm
well,
like, what?
I mean, that's pretty rough. Although I spent some time in Concord, North Carolina, which is right outside of Charlotte. And the TGI Fridays after 10 or 11 p.m., they clear out a bunch of the tables and bring in a DJ and becomes kind of like a line dancing bar. So this is not unique to the Chi-Chi's in New Jersey. I have experienced this in other places.
Okay,
Weird as hell. It's weird as hell. I'm not saying that's not the case, but it's not unique to this particular Chi-Chi's.
Right. So whenever I think of New Jersey, I think of the cop telling us that he can't help us if we don't know where we're going, and then Club Chi-Chi's. And yeah, I just didn't have a great experience in Jersey. I'd go back, but just this was a long time ago. So it's like word association, you know?
There's a lot of variance. It depends on where you are in the state. I can't recommend, you know, where I grew up is really nice. You know, Princeton, New Brunswick, where Rutgers is. The university towns are excellent. There's some places on the shore that are very nice, you know, not Jersey Shore nice, but actually legitimately nice. And then there's some places that are really, you know, rude, hostile, dangerous, dirty, whatever. So it's, you know, depending on where you are exactly, there's a pretty wide range in the kind of experience you can have.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned some of your after-school activities and that your school, you know, had after-school programs that allowed you to indulge in what you enjoy. Did any of your other interests, like commentating or basketball, take root at an early age too?
Yeah, I started playing basketball when I was pretty young. I mean, I played a lot of sports growing up, not really organized, but played a lot of pickup basketball, a lot of pickup football, played some little league as a kid. So I was pretty athletically involved. I don't know exactly when I kind of got the itch to start doing debate team stuff. It was probably around 7th or 8th grade.
I was in debate too.
Yeah, and then when I got to high school in the 9th grade, there was one of my most influential teacher, even though he was only an advisor, Mr. Fenster. He was running mock trial, model Congress, and model UN as after school activities, and I threw myself fully into that. I was all about it. And, you know, I had a lot more aptitude for it than playing sports, where my ceiling was, you know, maybe by senior year I'm starting varsity shooting guard or starting one of the starting wide receivers on the football team or whatever. Whereas with the debate team stuff, I was pretty apt at it right away. So I threw myself in that pretty thoroughly. I still played a lot of sports on the side, but in terms of dedicated extracurriculars, by the time I got high school, it was just all debate team, public policy, mock trial type of stuff.
Wow. So were you into politics at an early age? Like, what's Model UN? I've never heard of it.
Just Model United Nations. It's the same deal as Model Congress, except there's a policy. You play the role of a country for 9th or 10th graders. This usually means giving some really racist interpretation of some other country's policy in some racist-ass accent or whatever. But, you know, that's the spirit of it, is you're supposed to be simulating the United Nations.
Right. That kind of sounds like when I was in high school and we had the foreign club. So, like, I took 5 years of Spanish or 4 years of Spanish, and we had Spanish club. And, like, you know, we all had, like, maracas, and we'd watch Evita over and over again, and we'd make tostadas. And, yeah, looking back on it, it's like, how did we get away with that? But I get what you're saying.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that stuff a lot. By the time I hit my senior year, I was sort of disengaged with the club, which is still one of my biggest lifelong regrets, because I feel like that club and that group of teachers gave so much to me and helped me kind of pave the path that I'm leading now. Mm-hmm. And to kind of have the senioritis so bad that I was barely going to meetings. I actually got impeached. I was the president of junior. I was the president of Junior Statesman of America. I can't recall if this is my junior or senior year, but this was basically a more organized regional model Congress where everyone had their own little satellite, and I was the president and stopped showing up to meetings and was kind of just generally screwing around. And I actually had to go through an impeachment trial. I was impeached by members of my club and had to show up and give some sort of defense. This really happened. This
wow.
is a real thing. So I have a pretty rocky history with the debate team organization at Hillsborough overall, but I do remember it fondly, and it has a lot to do with the career that I've gotten to now, and not only just professionally, but the way that I view the world and the, you know, politics that I have or my feelings about social issues, whatever. A lot of that, the foundation was laid in that club, so it means a lot to me.
Well, if anybody ever questions, like, your badass cred, you can be like, hey, I was impeached from mock Congress. Yeah.
Yeah. Not many people can. I mean, there's presidents of all sorts of clubs, right? You talk to anyone, they're the president of some club or there's in high school. Not many people get impeached. That's a whole different can of worms. So, you know, I still have that edge at least.
Wow. I bow to you, sir. That is awesome.
Oh, I mean, it was pretty harrowing. And then afterwards, I had basically the people that were very loyal to me make sure I didn't get impeached. And then enacted vengeance on the people who were responsible for the impeachment trial. So it actually gave me a pretty good foundation for what real life politics works like. So in that sense, it was a very valuable experience.
Wow. See, I did debate, but my problem was you had to debate. There was like a form to debate, and like you had to do things in a certain order in a certain way, and then you had to let your opponent speak. And I would just sort of go off on these tangents, and then whenever the points would come in afterwards, I would not really get a lot of points. And when I would look at the scorecard, they would be like, you know, we appreciate your gusto and your passion for the air pollution topic. However, you did need to let your opponent speak. And I used to just, I would never do anything, you know, nice and framed. I would just sort of be erratic and passionate, but.
Yeah, that's the difference between a debate and an argument.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, sometimes you're supposed to be doing A and sometimes you're supposed to be doing B.
Right. I'm just a passionate person. What can I say?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, there's been definitely more ills have occurred in human history by people being not passionate enough than people being too passionate. So if you have to err on one side, it's better to be too passionate.
Absolutely. So how did you get into magic?
So my mom every Christmas bought me and my younger brother a game of some sort of board game. She would go to the store in the mall called the Gamekeeper. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, but this kind of predates the Wizards play stores that were around in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Okay.
I think Wizards eventually bought Gamekeeper out and then turned them into the Wizards Organized Play Stores. Mm-hmm. So she would go in every Christmas and just buy some random game that the person working behind the counter would suggest. So one year it was a pair of Magic starters. My brother and I just got one of those two-player revised sets that they're purportedly sealed decks, but they're actually just a bunch of packs slapped together. So if you try to build decks out of it, it's a disaster. It was a rawer time for Magic.
Did they come with a really fat rule book that unfolded 20 different ways?
No, it was a small, thick rule book, but it wasn't one of the big unfolding ones.
You know what I'm talking about that came with like the fourth edition?
Yes, I do. No, that, It predates those.
Okay.
So my brother and I started playing Magic, and we were enjoying it. And then it turns out one of my best friends, Eugene Harvey, who I played Dungeons & Dragons with and played basketball with and video games, whatever, when I told him, oh, I got this game and it's pretty sweet, he says, yeah, me and your other friend Justin and these two other people that you're friends with, we've been playing it for a couple months now and we really like it. So I already had a group of people to start playing with. And Eugene is not a player who a lot of people remember, but he has a number of Pro Tour top eights and was for a while one of America's best players. And he was a savant from day one. I mean, there's no question about it. He just got the game on some fundamental level. And so a lot of whatever, you know, ability that I've accumulated over the years, a lot of it was just the good fortune of being good friends with Eugene Harvey and living down the street from him and being able to play a bunch of games, mm-hmm. you know, in the 7th and 8th and 9th grade together.
Yeah. So what motivated you to want to go to the competitive side of Magic? Because you had some success for a little while.
A little bit. I think the first real tournament that I remember, I wasn't even playing in it, but they had these Grey Matter tournaments. They were these tournaments that were held in New York and New Jersey. Brian David Marshall actually ran the tournaments.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is when he was a tournament organizer connected with Neutral Ground. And I wasn't, you know, I was still playing at my local store and wasn't really comfortable with playing in these large tournaments. But Eugene was going out to play in their big standard at the time called Type 2 tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Justin and the other people, you know, Eugene, he won every local tournament. I mean, he was just the best guy that we played with by a mile. No one could touch him. And I remember thinking, Eugene's going to go to this tournament, and if he wins, that's what I would expect, because I've never met anyone better than him at it.
Mm-hmm.
And if Eugene doesn't do well, that means there's this whole big, you know, vast country of other players and ability levels, and I'm really intrigued by that possibility. So Eugene went out there, and I think he went either 5-4 or 6-3. And when he told me that, I said, oh my God, like, I couldn't really imagine someone really being better than Eugene. And for him to go to a tournament where a bunch of people beat him made me feel like there's this larger community, there's this larger experience, there's so much room for growth. And not that I really intellectualized it that at that level when I was 15, but those were kind of the feelings that were going through my head. And once that happened, I was really interested in starting to play at larger events and see what the bigger scene was all about. I didn't start playing in PTQs until I think my first format was Masks Block Constructed.
Mm-hmm.
So there's probably 3 or 4 solid years where I was playing a lot at local stores and playing at, you know, big New Jersey tournaments. But I didn't get involved in formal organized play until I think the year 2000 or 1999.
Mm-hmm. Did seeing how Eugene did encourage you to give it a try because it maybe made you thought that you would have a chance? Because like you said, you put him on such a high pedestal of how good he was, and then other people were able to beat him. Did it maybe make you feel like you had a chance too? You know what I mean? Like,
not necessarily. It just made me feel like I'm just starting to scratch the surface of what this is.
Mm.
We're playing our games. We all think we're playing really well. We know Eugene's better than us. We're not really sure why, but we know he wins the most.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that there's something so much larger out there, the decks that people are building, the plays they're making, everything about it, how large the tournaments are, the whole thing. You know, I got this appreciation that this could be something way larger than me playing in my basement with my friends or going to the local comic store and playing some random games on a Friday. And after that tournament, even though I didn't participate, I was really intrigued by what that larger experience was.
Mm-hmm. Did you know how far you wanted to take it? Like, did you want to be on the Pro Tour, or were you just sort of seeing what you could make of it?
More of the second thing. The mm-hmm. Pro Tour always seems so inaccessible to me. I mean, mm-hmm. when you start reading about players and coverage, and, you know, coverage was a way different animal back then. We're basically talking about articles and magazines.
Yeah.
The internet was basically even a non-existent thing as far as Magic coverage goes. But when I heard about, you know, the decks they were playing that were nothing like the decks that I was playing, and the manner in which they qualified for the Pro Tour, and just kind of their age and freedom too. You know, I was 16, 17 years old. My parents were not cool with me traveling for Magic tournaments. So,
oh, really?
Yep, for sure. So it all felt very distant, but I just kind of wanted to see, like you said, where could I go with this? What would the experience be like? I've always been interested in just kind of exploration.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have any particular goals in mind. I just wanted to see what was up.
Mm-hmm. And then eventually you took a job as a game designer with Cryptozoic. What was that experience like?
Well, initially, my first foot in the door in the industry was with Upper Deck Entertainment.
Okay.
I got a contracting gig to work on Versus, and that sort of parlayed into a larger stint out there. And then when Upper Deck Entertainment kind of went under, then Cryptozoic picked up the WoW TCG license, which I was working on. And it was a really fun environment. There's a lot of people that I met that I was friends with beforehand or met on the job that has since become very close friends. There's a lot of people, you know, Danny Mandel, who never really worked at Cryptozoic, but he was an Upper Deck guy, Ben Jacoski and Matt Place, I consider three game designers who I hold in incredibly high esteem, and they're the people that I learned, I feel like, the majority of my craft from. So it's a very fun environment. There's a lot of really good people, and from a learning experience, there's some people there that I hold in the highest regard. None of them are actually there anymore. They're all kind of off doing their own things. Mm-hmm. But the experience of getting to learn alongside and underneath some of those people is, you know, a professional experience I cherish quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, had you always wanted to get into game design, or was this something you sort of fell into?
More of the second thing. Mm-hmm. Like, my answer to basically every other question you're going to ask.
I should mix it up then.
Well, you know, it was right after the Versus system launched, and they kind of knew me from my Pro Tour background. So they were willing to give me an internship. They were also recruiting my then wife to come out and edit for them. So
I didn't know you were married.
I was, yes.
I had no idea.
So to kind of sweeten the pot to get her to come out there, which was really what they were after, they said, oh, and we'll give Patrick a 6-month internship because we know him from the Pro Tour and maybe he has some chops. Mm-hmm. So, you know, after 6 months, my contract got extended and then it extended again and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Eventually landing to the spot where they offered me full-time work, and I've been kind of involved ever since. So definitely kind of fell into it. Though the idea of designing games and working on games, I didn't even realize it was a potential career. But it's always something where we were making up rules or trying to improve the games we were playing or inventing our own games, whatever. So it's not something that I had no background in. I mean, I had no formal background, obviously, but on an intellectual level, it was something that I was always interested in.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me. What career path do you think you were headed down if you weren't in game design? Like, what would you be doing?
Well, there's two answers to that question. There's the answer when I was 15 or 16, where I would have told you that I'm going to be a lawyer or working in the United Nations or something. And then there's post dropout of college, working at the game store of me, that would have told you I'm going to play poker for a living, or I'm going to be selling drugs, or like not even kidding. Like, I'm just going to be on some sort of hustle because I can't work a 9-to-5 and my education opportunities are closed to me and I'm just going to have to figure something out. So I don't know what I would be doing now if I didn't get the opportunity to work at Upper Deck. I figure, you know, I might still be spinning my tires somewhere, or maybe I would have figured something else out. I have no idea, but, you know, I have different answers to that question. I still don't even know ultimately what I want to be doing mm-hmm. with my life. I mean, I'm very happy doing game design and I love the commentary work. The traveling's very cool. You know, I'm happy with what I'm doing. But do I want to be doing game design and Magic coverage for the next 25, 30, 35 years? I'm not so sure. Mm-hmm. But I figure, you know, when I have a better answer to that question, if there is a better answer to that question, I'll figure it out at the right time.
It's funny, when I was researching you, I did find a Facebook post that you had wrote some time ago, and you listed some of your realistic dream jobs. Do you remember this?
Vaguely.
Okay. I will read them to you. One of them you listed was a front office employee for an NBA team. You didn't specify which one. You also said you wouldn't mind being an entourage member of theoretical upcoming white rapper.
Yep.
And then your last one was rotation player for 2011-2012 Charlotte Bobcats.
Oh, that was at the time where the Charlotte Bobcats were historically bad. So I was like, well, there's no difference between me and the last guy you got on the bench. You might as well plug me in for a couple minutes. All those, I would say, are still theoretical dream jobs, though.
Yeah.
At age 32, turning 33, whatever NBA life I have ahead of me, that door is quickly closing. I actually think that NBA front office personnel is something I would still love to do, and not – I would say greater than 0% chance of happening, probably still less than 1%, but not a total impossibility.
Okay.
I was on a flight with Cedric where he and I were talking about basketball, And it turns out, and the New Orleans Pelicans were a team we were talking about quite a bit for whatever reason. And it turns out randomly that the person sitting in front of us on the airplane was Del Demps, the general manager of the New Orleans Pelicans.
Wow.
So after the flight, he came up to me and Cedric, and he was like, "Hey, you guys really know your stuff. If you, you know, talk to us about basketball for a while," and was basically told us, you know, stay visible. So I have some very, 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 very small in somewhere on the NBA level. Wow. And white entourage member, I do feel I would still be very passionate about that work. I feel like, though, now that my Google searches are turning up so many, you know, me in a tie talking about a Magic, I think some of my street credibility might be ruined. It didn't affect Rick Ross too much. He was able to be a correctional officer and still rap about selling drugs or whatever. So you can still do it. But it is – the credibility has taken a knock with my career trajectory over the last couple of years.
But like I said, you were impeached as a school president. I mean, that's how many verses right there?
That's I would struggle to get more than one out of that experience. I don't know if there's a whole lot of content there. But, you know, I spend some time on my ass on the street. You know, I probably have two or three songs worth of that kind of material in me. But after that, I would have to be kind of in the background and more entourage member than actual producer of content.
You could be more like the hype man. So like when the main person is rapping, you could just be the person where every 5 seconds you just do, oh, yeah.
I'm not bad at that stuff. If you're entering a ring for a boxing match or a wrestling match, you need someone to announce you, where you're from, your name, all that. I'm actually pretty legitimately good at that stuff. So there are other ways for me to parlay this whole speaking professionally thing. And hopefully in due course, I can figure it out.
So you left Cryptozoic for Stoneblade Entertainment initially. What prompted that decision?
There's a couple things. One, a lot of the people over at Stoneblade have been good friends of mine. I mean, me and John Fiorello, Justin Gary, those were some of my earliest friends from the Pro Tour. Brian Kibler I've known for a very long time. And so there was some charm in going and working with friends. And for whatever reason, at Cryptozoic rather, something was just not clicking anymore. Mm-hmm. Like I was going to work, wasn't engaged, felt burned upon when people asked me for help. I was just in a bad place with it. So I felt like for my own sake, I kind of needed to switch up what I was doing, and the allure of working with a really talented group of people and a lot of people that I've been friends with for a very long time was really hard to turn down. I mean, me and the Stoneblade guys were talking for years about me eventually hopping ship over there, but there was always, you know, either it was difficult for them to make the money work on their end because they were still growing, or I was pretty happy with the work at Cryptozoic, or I was feeling some inertia about moving. But eventually we hit a spot where we were able to get all of our needs to align in the right way. And then I hopped over.
Now, what is it about game design that you enjoy?
The thing that I enjoy the most is you go to a show and there's two people and they're sitting at a table and they are playing something that you worked on, and they are laughing and they are smiling and they are sharing some sort of moment. That feeling, the first time that I ever experienced that working at Upper Deck, feels the exact same way as it does now. Yeah. That has never diminished one bit. So from a visceral level, the feeling of watching people enjoy your labor, you know, there's no replacement for that. Kind of on a day-to-day level now, I think the intellectual challenge of there's a lot of smart people in the room, there's a lot of ideas bouncing around, there's a lot of competing priorities. Let's sit down and use our creativity and our intellect and our work ethic and try to drive at the best possible solution. I think that kind of work, it reminds me a lot of, honestly, doing as silly of a parallel as this sounds, some of like the mock trial Model UN Model Congress work of, let's all sit down together and use our collective skills to try to draw the best possible conclusion. Because so much work in life, so many processes are so monopolized, or there's a lot of politics on the line, or people are acting with bad intentions. And with game design, when it's at its best, it's just the intentions are pure, and all that matters is what you come out with at the end. Mm-hmm. And I work much better in collaborative environments than I do in isolation. Mm-hmm. And so doing collaborative work, which my game design work is really awesome for me too. I mean, I'm with Magic, I always perform better at team Pro Tours and team Grand Prix than individual ones, because I worked harder, I cared more, I tried harder in the matches, because it's not just you you're playing for or working for. There's a whole group of people you've grown connected to and you've worked together with. And that feeling of, I don't know, collectiveness and, you know, shared responsibility and shared output, I really enjoy it a lot.
Sure. I still feel that way about my Community Cup team. I still miss those people. It's been about a week and a half, and we're still finding ways to, like, keep in touch. And, oh, remember when we did this, and remember this picture we took, and I totally get that. So.
Well, I mean, that's going to be an experience that you and everyone else there get to carry for the rest of your lives. And what you accomplished, everyone contributed to that. Yeah. And the end result is something that gets to be your small piece of Magic history that lives forever. And when you get to have moments like that, it's really special. And game design at its best is it's every day you're doing things like that, not at that scale or scope or with the public visibility that you're describing with the Community Cup, but it's a lot of the same emotion.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does game design affect what you do as a commentator or even as a player?
Well, as a commentator, it gives me a very odd perspective because when people mess up on camera, which happens pretty regularly, it's an easy instinct to go to of, well, that person's just playing bad. Mm-hmm. And you hear a lot of commentators say things like that, even though, you know, you're not really supposed to. As a competitive player, it's hard to shut off that instinct to just say that person just played bad. Mm-hmm. As a game designer, what intrigues me is when I see someone make a play that doesn't make sense, I think, what is going on in their head that would cause them to draw that conclusion? What were they thinking about, or what were the variables that they were trying to juggle? Which I think gives me, you know, a lot of context as a commentator, because I can describe what I think someone's thought process is, which is an angle that I think is more intriguing than just saying, well, that person's an idiot and they screwed up or whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. And then you can translate that to your game design work as well. You know, are there keywords or mechanics that are not intuitive, don't work the way that people think they do? People regularly trip up. When you see that stuff happen on camera over and over again, it gives you a lot of do's and don'ts principles on game design as well. So I feel like they definitely overlap for me a lot, both in the perspective that they give me, which I think is unique in, as far as the industry goes, and also because witnessing people play games helps your game design work, and working on games yourself helps you discuss games.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you became involved with Star City Games.
Well, a couple of years ago, their commentary process was a lot less formalized than it is now. Mm-hmm. They were just giving people random stabs at the booth. Whoever was local, if people wanted to hop in randomly for a round in their regular civilian clothes, like whatever. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Open that I won in New Jersey in 2011, I actually thought I was going to be doing commentary for some of the day because I just went up to the booth and said, hey, can I hop in for a few rounds? I'd been in the booth before. And they said, no, we're actually good. And then I ended up playing the tournament. So I got my shot to do it. My first show, I worked in Los Angeles, and it was with Adrian Sullivan. And I'm pretty sure the reason that I got the opportunity to do the show was they wouldn't have to pay for a flight because I could just drive myself from San Diego to Los Angeles and work the show. And I guess they felt that I did, you know, a good enough job where they were giving me, you know, willing to give me another chance and then willing to give me another chance. And then when they wanted to come up with a more formalized commentary roster, Cedric and I were at the, I suppose, the top of the list of people they approached, and we were really happy to take on that opportunity. So I kind of, again, sort of backdoored, stumbled my way into it, but, you know, I made, I guess, a good enough stab with the opportunities that I got, and Star City was happy enough, and here we are now doing 35 shows a year.
Wow. Now, how do you work on your craft, or how do you improve it? Do you go back and watch old footage to see what you can improve on, or do you guys have meetings about that? Like, what's the process there?
Both. I mean, first of all, I definitely go back and listen to everything. It's impossible to listen to the entire broadcast because it's, you know, 30 hours of content or 25 hours of content. So I can't go back and listen to the whole thing. But I do go back and listen to chunks. And in fact, I was not aware of how many times I was saying like or when I was trying to fill in space between thoughts until I went back and listened to my coverage and was thinking to myself, holy shit, this is happening all the time. I need to be thinking about this. So I do go back and I listen to it. And Cedric and I, we have a really, you know, a really open relationship with each other where if we have a round where something went wrong, if I thought Cedric dropped the ball on something, or if he thought I dropped the ball on something, or if we thought the producers dropped the ball or vice versa, we can just say, we screwed that round up. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. And there's no hard feelings. There's so much respect professionally that I have for Cedric and vice versa, and that we have for the rest of the Star City Games staff, you know, the producers and the directors. that you don't get to see on the broadcast, but who are incredible talents as well. You know, I think there's enough mutual respect there that whenever someone feels like something wrong is going on, we can just talk about it and no one has a bruised ego.
And you brought up a really good point. I think one of the reasons why the stream is so successful is because of your chemistry with Cedric Phillips and your friendship. What is it that makes your friendship with him work, or what is it that brings you two together?
Well, we've been friends for a long time, so that helps. And we have a lot of the same shared magic experiences because we were kind of coming up and grinding and playing in PTs around the same time. I predate him a little bit. Most of my Pro Tour experience was in the early 2000s. And most of his was in the mid-2000s. But we still share a lot of the same stories and same people and all that kind of stuff. Besides that, I think that there's a lot of places where Cedric and I share very similar interests. We're both very passionate about, you know, sports, particularly basketball. We both grew up heavily influenced by professional wrestling and still watch quite a bit of it now. And, you know, we both are very passionate about music, although our tastes are very different. And then there's some... And then there's some places where we're very different people. I think that for me, Cedric's work ethic is astounding. And watching how hard he works every week, not only with the commentary, but with his responsibilities as the content coordinator for Star City Games, I think that I draw a lot watching him in terms of how I should be conducting myself professionally and how hard I need to be working and how I need to drive myself up if I want to, you know, advance to the next level of things. And for Cedric, I think being around me, you know, Cedric has a personality where he's just very much trying to brute force solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, he's very confident in his own abilities and he often is just like, just push forward and keep working and we'll figure things out. And I'm a lot more reflective. And I often say, all right, let's take a step back here, examine the process and try to figure out where we're being inefficient or where our logic isn't sound or whatever the case may be. And I think that, you know, the way that he approaches problems with on a professional level, at least with me, is very different now than it was a couple of years ago. He's definitely picked up a little bit of that and added to his own repertoire of handling problems. So, you know, I think we have a lot of shared interests and shared experiences, but we're also very different people and we can learn a lot from each other in the ways that we're different as well.
Sure. Sure. Now, one of the things I find fascinating about people is their lifestyle, their version of the grind. How do you juggle everything between the day job, commentating, making time to actually enjoy your hobbies, a relationship if you have one? Like, walk me through a typical week in your life. Like, how do you do this?
Well, I mean, my weeks are fairly fluid, whether I'm doing game design work or not. Sometimes I'm in the office a couple days a week. Sometimes I'm working from home. Sometimes I'm taking a day to just relax. So there's not, it's hard to quantify what the grind exactly looks like because the weeks where I have a show and the weeks that I don't have a show are very different.
Okay.
And because there's so many demands on my time at this point, I have to sort of walk into the week compartmentalizing and laying out the specific things I want to get done.
Okay.
So for example, 2 weeks ago, I said, you know what? I want to be playing a lot of Hearthstone. So I set a lot of things aside and devoted a lot of my free time to just doing that. This week, I'm feeling like I have not been in the gym nearly as much as I should be, mm-hmm. and I need to be working on my health and fitness. So a lot of other things are being shoved aside to spend some time focusing on that. And that's how most of that goes. I do have a girlfriend. She's currently in graduate school up in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. So seeing her is complicated, though usually, you know, once a month or so, if there's a weekend off, I can get up there and we can hang out for a bit. She's originally from San Diego. And when she finished up her school this year, she'll probably be coming back down here. Although, you know, with her searching for work, who knows exactly how that's gonna play out.
Sure.
But, you know, if we're not seeing each other that week, we try to spend, you know, one evening on Skype talking and, you know, we text regularly. So usually I walk into the week saying, what's the thing that I want to focus on outside of work and outside of the bare necessities to get through the week? And that's what takes up my time outside of making sure that the laundry gets done and I go to work and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. How do you deal with being on the road so much? And I'm assuming you're living out of suitcases.
Well, I still have my apartment and it's still my home for, mm-hmm. you know, during the week while I'm here. It's tough. It's one of those things where every day that leads up to the event, you sort of have to cross some things off the list to get done, whether it's dry cleaning where it's making sure that certain errands are done. So the whole week leading up to the event every day there's some, you know, small number of tasks that I need to get accomplished to make sure I can be gone for 3.5 or 4 days and things don't fall apart in my absence. Mm-hmm. As far as life on the road goes, I've always liked traveling and I fly pretty well and I've gotten adjusted to it at this point. So it's fine from that standpoint. Sometimes I do get a little homesick or I miss being around my friends as much as I used to be, which has kind of been the hardest transition. But in terms of being acclimated to just being on a plane and being in random cities and sleeping in hotels, I'm fine with all that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm that doesn't bother me too much, but feeling like I don't have my roots planted as firmly someplace, sometimes that is troubling for me.
I remember you said earlier in the show that your parents weren't thrilled with the idea of you traveling for magic events back when you were in your teens. What do they think of what you do now?
Oh, they're all about it. Yeah. I mean, there was a point where right after I dropped out of school, I got kicked out of my house because I wasn't working and I wasn't going to school.
Wow.
So I was 19 years old and kind of on my ass. And like, they were justified. Like, there's grievances on both sides at the time that are totally legitimate. I was not the easiest kid to raise. There were some places where they screwed up, whatever. That it's all water on the bridge now, where we talk all the time and we're totally good. But there was a while where we weren't talking or we were talking very rarely. And there was a point where I went away to Japan for a pro tour. And I came back and I heard through the grapevine that my mom had mentioned to someone, well, you know, we kicked him out because he was really immature and couldn't get anything in his life straightened out. But if he went to Japan by himself and came back and didn't get killed, then he's probably got a little more independence and maturity than we gave him credit for. So even though they were not, you know, I was working at the card store and playing in tournaments, whatever, they were not thrilled about that lifestyle by any stretch of the imagination. But once it became, you know, all right, well, I'm starting to do reasonably well in tournaments. Okay, that's good. All right, well, the store is doing okay. All right, that's good. All right, I have this opportunity out in California to leverage these abilities I've built up to maybe make games. They were very excited about that. And now, you know, when we talk about it, they jokingly say, you know, you proved us wrong. We would have never guessed in a million years that this would have been the way that things played out. But now, you know, my father's father, he, you know, got my grandmother pregnant with my dad when he was 18 or 19 years old. They're out of wedlock, piss poor. And my grandfather started a rental car business, renting the one car that he owned around to other people. And out of this built a very successful car rental, you know, empire in central New Jersey. And so my dad's always been, and my mom to the same extent, have always been amenable to the idea of just carve out your own path. Go ahead and do whatever it is that you think maximizes your own skills. Now, they weren't happy with me playing Magic because they thought that they wanted me to go to Princeton and become a lawyer or whatever. That was what their idea for me was, I think. And when that didn't, not only did that not happen, but I was also dropping out of school, hanging out with these people they didn't like, getting into all sorts of trouble, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that Magic sort of became this, you know, larger narrative about how their son was screwing up really badly. And once it became clear that that wasn't exactly what was going on, that there were elements of that for sure. And there were times where I was blowing off real responsibilities to go play in Magic tournaments and all that stuff. But once I got to the point where I had a job and a paycheck and, you know, things were, I was turning into a real adult, you know, they got very supportive of it.
And you're wearing a suit all the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I couldn't actually tell them about the coverage for a little bit because back when we had those horrible SEG Live, like the black button-down shirts, and then for a while we were wearing a jacket with a T-shirt but no tie, I didn't want to tell my dad about it because if he saw the broadcast and saw his son in a sports jacket and a T-shirt, he'd be so pissed off. So I had to wait to really loop them in on exactly what was going on once the dress code was up to snuff, you know?
Now, in addition to being known for your commentary, you're also widely known for being a red mage. I am, of course, a black mage who doesn't really like red. Mm-hmm. I'll have you know that I have the John Avon lithographs.
Okay.
And I have yet to hang up the mountain.
Oh, seriously? Come on. You can't. You don't like red. That's totally fine. Everyone has their preferences. But to single it out like that, that's That's pretty brutal.
I know. But in addition to that, you know, you're also known for trying to change the perception that people have about red decks, because people do feel like they're easy to play, or like they involve less skill, or like they might be, you know, cheap or whatever. If somebody was listening to this show and they felt that way, what would you say to them to convince them otherwise?
I would say that every Magic deck tests different skills. I think that red aggressive decks often have the least margin for error because your cards are objectively way less powerful than what your opponent is bringing to the table. So if you slip up, it's way less likely to, or it's way more likely to matter, rather. Mm-hmm. There are some games where you just steamroll someone or they stall on lands and die. But almost when anyone stalls on lands, they just die. Even if it's a control deck and it takes you 20 turns to finally kill them, the same thing's happening. And the control decks, if you look at standards, you know, last season standard, for example, there were games where, yeah, I have to decide whether I want to Syncopate on two or Azorius Charm this creature, or do I need a Detention Sphere, this Planeswalker, can I save it for something else? There were definitely those games that were pretty hard to play. But there's also games where you go, yeah, dissolve your first play, untap, Jace minus it, all right, get another counterspell, untap, Detention Sphere your play, make some land drops, Revelation. I mean, super straightforward games that anyone can pilot. Those also exist with the control decks. Mm-hmm. And for the beatdown decks, yeah, you have some games where you go one top, two drop, three drop, and your opponent doesn't really do anything, you just kill them. But there's also the games where, all right, what's the removal spell I'm playing around here? What order do I need to sequence my threats? Do I need to try to bluff and damage on this turn because the game's starting to get away from me and I just need to start taking risks? Those are skills that aren't tested playing most other decks that do add up to wins and losses. So I would say basically every deck has games where it's hard, and whether or not you're good at playing the deck matters. And there are some games where it's challenging, and whether or not you are good at playing the deck matters a ton. And the way they manifest and the different skills they're testing are different from deck to deck. But that element exists in all decks of Magic.
Okay. Does it bother you when you hear people badmouth red decks?
No, because most people who badmouth red decks aren't a tenth as good as I am. You know what I mean? It's
how?
If we're going to be honest here, you know what I mean? It's the average person I hear at a PTQ who is, you know, saying, oh, I just lost to this idiot playing mono red, and only idiots play that deck. Listen, man, if we played 20 games of a mirror match or your deck against my deck, I tell you, the results are going to be a lot different than you expect them to be. So it's never really bothered me that much. When it comes from someone good who I know that it's basically a slight out of love. And when it comes from someone who is ill-informed, I know that they're ill-informed, and it doesn't really bother me.
Now, I noticed with your example that you mentioned mono red in terms of an aggro deck. Do you play – I can't even say it. Do you play burn decks, Patrick? Burn?
Occasionally. Okay. Well, here's the thing.
Okay.
My preferred style of red deck that I play – some burn spells, but a lot of creatures.
Okay.
So sometimes, you know, you use them as removal spells. Sometimes your opponent isn't playing creatures, or the game's drawn out and you can top deck some things. Those are my favorite style of red decks to play. As far as Legacy is concerned, the nature of the format means you just have to play the burn style of deck. It's the only thing that can compete because the format's just – it's too fast, and you need to not interact with people to be effective if you're playing a deck like Burn. So you can't put a bunch of creatures on the table that they're able to bolt and plow and et cetera. So in the formats where it's appropriate to play Burn decks, I will do it sometimes. But my preference, I would say, you know, if I had to play 20 lands and 40 cards, I think 28 creatures, 12 Burn spells is about my sweet spot of where I would be the happiest.
Okay, and see, I can hang with that. I get frustrated when I'm playing it because I just started getting into Modern, which I really enjoy. And the Modern burn decks are like 4 Goblin Guides, 4 crazy Unearth Elemental person, and then like 29 burn spells. And it's like,
yeah, some Eidolons, maybe.
Yeah, you know, that just chaps my ass. I just can't.
No, I do not enjoy playing decks like that. There was one point where I was playing in a Legacy Open many years ago where I thought that creatures were really bad in Legacy because there were too many Snapcaster, Swords to Plowshares, and there was some other cheap removal spell that the deck at the time was playing. Mm-hmm. But basically, I felt like I was losing too many games to just drawing creatures. So I said, all right, I'm going to cut all the creatures. I'm going to put in a bunch of Ankh of Mishras, and I'm going to put in a bunch of some other burn spell. So the deck was literally 20 lands and 40 burn spells, and I did not have fun playing that deck because it's just – you know, I'm playing around Daze and I'm playing around Spell Pierce, and sometimes it's thoughtful or engaging on that level. But by and large, it was just I was not having fun, and my opponents certainly weren't having fun. So I would prefer, you know, the modern build of Burn is a little too extreme for me. I would prefer to play with a build that's a lot more creature-centric and fewer Lava Spikes.
My
I
don't kind actually of like.
Here's the thing. I don't actually like playing with Lava Spike very much.
Yeah.
I like playing with Lightning Bolt. I like playing with Stagger Shock. I like playing with, you know, Volcanic Hammers, Incinerates, whatever. Things that are flexible and give me different options depending on the way the game is shaping up. Playing with the cards that are just deal three to the player. Like, I'll get my hands dirty, whatever. I'll play with those cards, but it's not exactly my idea of a good time.
I'm a recent convert to Team Lightning Bolt. I started playing Jund and Modern, and I was playing the Rock, and then I moved on to Junk, and I didn't like any of those. And then Andrew Boswell did pretty well at GP Boston with a Jund list, and I tried it out, and I loved it. And for the first couple times I played it, I was like, I'm like, Lightning Bolt. Okay, so I tap this... three damage. I'm a black mage, so the idea of just doing raw damage is very strange to me. So I was just like, three damage. Oh, I can do it to anything I want. Hey! And I started having fun with it, where like I would block with something, and it would have a little bit of damage left to go, bam, lightning bolt, or a turn one lightning bolt, or I'd fry your birds, and I love it. I'm a big fan of lightning bolt now.
It's hard to go wrong. It's hard to target the wrong thing, you know what I mean? It's gonna kill something. Have you actually spoken to Andrew Boswell?
I have not, no, but I have played the list at FNM, and I love it. Why should I? Is he a good person?
Oh, he is. I've recently encountered this gentleman, and he is one of my absolute favorites in the community. If you get an opportunity, you can find him at an event. I would definitely seek him out and talk to him, because he's a cool dude.
Yeah. And it's even funny, like, I keep forgetting how versatile Lightning Bolt is, but there was a game at FNM where my opponent was literally at three life, and I'm going over everything, and I'm like, and he has blockers, and I can't, how am I hey, three damage, you're dead. It was a very foreign concept to me. It was very cool. I'm like, oh, sweet, I just won with a Lightning Bolt. And yeah, it's just really outside of my wheelhouse.
Oh, now when I get some to three, I'm like, all right, this person's dead. It's just a matter of when. I mean, I don't know if it's next turn or three turns from now, but it's going to be happening at some point.
I know. I'm learning. So when I was researching you, another thing I found out about you, Patrick, is that you seem to be an advocate for equality and for getting rid of hate speech and magic, like the homophobic slurs and using the word rape capriciously. I saw that you were also against Prop 8, which was awesome. Why does all this mean so much to you?
So, I mean, there's a couple reasons. One is we should just be striving for equality and understanding of one another no matter what. I mean, as long as people are, you know, involved in things that only affect themselves or involved in consenting relationships, nothing else should matter. It should be no one's place to tell someone what they should or should not do with themselves or with people both of whom are consenting to whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it's especially important in Magic because, you know, for a lot of people, Magic, you know, getting into the game, a lot of people are introverted, not necessarily the most social, not necessarily the cool kids at school. For a lot of people, it's escapism for bad situations at home or whatever the case may be. And even for people who don't have that experience, who were actually in, you know, the cool kids club or whatever you want to call it, Magic was something that they probably had to conceal from their peers or take shit about constantly. So we all have this shared experience of getting sand kicked in our face in life or for choosing to play Magic or whatever the case may be. And this should be some sort of haven or shelter where people can come together and just enjoy this, because a lot of other elements in life do not afford these people, myself, yourself, millions of other people, these opportunities to necessarily have that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And not only should we be striving for that kind of in this general sense, but Magic specifically is not—it's not just any other game or any other community. You know, when I think about where I am at professionally, the experience I've had in my life, the friendships I've made, everything—the vocabulary that I have—Magic's given me so much. It's not just some other game. It's not just some other experience. And the idea that someone would be denied that experience or opt out of that experience because the community was so fiercely unfriendly, homophobic, misogynistic, racist, whatever, makes me really sad, because I think that this is something Magic has the possibility to be a huge benefit for people, not only just in terms of critical thinking skills and mathematics, but just these shared social experiences, these shared competitive experiences that are hard to replicate in life in other venues. So we should be doing it anyway, and specifically with Magic because of the nature of the community and the type of experience that it can provide when it's at its best.
That's very well said. So, in a recent article at Star City, you said, "For now, my home is in the booth, but I could see that changing somewhere down the line." What would have to happen for you to want to get back into competitive Magic? Do you miss it?
To some extent. I feel like if I could play in one Pro Tour a year, I'd be extremely happy. And I would pay a lot to be able to play in one Pro Tour a year. I got to play in the Ravnica Block Pro Tour last year, or maybe 2 years ago now. On the heels of a Grand Prix finish in Charlotte. And that was an incredible experience. And I missed it. You know, I hadn't played in a Pro Tour up until that point for 6 or 7 years. So, you know, getting able to touch that again was really great. For me, it's tough because of the commentary and the game design. I've just been in the Sausage Factory too long, where it's hard for me to be really immersed in a tournament setting. It still happens from time to time. And, you know, when I've run deep in tournaments, I can definitely feel it coming back. But, you know, I'm at Grand Prix Sydney, for example. I went there kind of as a vacation and kind of just to play in a tournament because I had the weekend off this summer. And I lost in round two. And I was sort of like, you know, I'm kind of just done with this. Like, I don't have it in me to try to push for a 6-1 record through these next 7 rounds or whatever it's going to take. My seal deck's kind of bad. I'm not feeling great. The loss I just took kind of stunk. Like, whatever, I'm done with it. And I know me 12 years ago would have said, all right, going to win the next 7, and then the next 6 after that, and the next 3 after that, I'm going to win this thing, you know? So there's definitely been a shift in the mentality. The hardest thing to leave behind are the people, you know? Like, I see even your, you know, stuff coming in from your Twitter feed about the Community Cup and people going to karaoke and, you know, the shot of, you know, you guys holding the trophy. Like, that's what I miss, the camaraderie and the shared experiences. And, you know, I'm not doing well in the tournament, but my buddy over there is, and I'm on the rail hanging, you know, life and death on my friend's match right now. That's the stuff that I really miss. And I think that if I wasn't doing commentary, that would still be attractive enough for me to get back into trying to play the game a lot and being more active. But, you know, the factors have changed now. For me, it's more of being in touch with the community and being around my friends and getting to experience the extracurricular activities, which I miss a lot, and that's a big drive to get back there. But in terms of topping another Grand Prix, qualifying for another Pro Tour, whatever the case may be, that's not a huge passion for me anymore. That could change. I totally accept that could change because – in 2008, I would have told you, like, fuck that, I'm never playing in one of those Pro Tours ever again. And, you know, when I did get to play, it mattered quite a bit to me. Mm-hmm. But for now, the priorities have changed, the perspective's changed, and it's not the focus it once was.
So with that said, Patrick, where do you see yourself in the next few years?
Well, I see myself doing commentary for Star City Games in 2015, for short. And hopefully beyond that and beyond that. That's the thing. Like, what makes that question very hard for me to answer is I feel like Magic is really on the ground floor of what it could be from a coverage perspective. There are, you know, millions of people worldwide playing Magic. Websites like Magic's main webpage, Star City Games, they get hundreds of thousands of viewers a month coming to the website. Mm-hmm. When Wizards has a Grand Prix or when Star City Games doesn't open, and let's say we get 8,000 viewers on a weekend, or that's what our average is. That's a really successful show for us.
Yeah.
And you can't tell me that we have millions of people playing this game and hundreds of thousands of people reading the content, and 7,000 people is the cap on what we can get on an Open or a Grand Prix or a Pro Tour. That's nonsense.
Yeah.
There's so much room for growth, both from a production standpoint, commentators getting better, myself included. You know, Magic's digital reach growing, the game growing in a general sense, the type of eyeballs that, you know, games like Hearthstone can provide, other TCGs. There's so much room for growth that if you had told me 5 years ago this is what I would be doing now, I would have laughed you out of the room. I would have told you there's no way. Mm-hmm. And I think that what Magic coverage could be like 5 years from now could be a whole different animal than what it is right now. I think we are just scratching the surface of what this could possibly be. So when I think about my career trajectory, I'm like, well, you know, I'll be in the booth for a couple of years and maybe I'll keep doing it for longer than that. Or maybe I'll refocus on game design, or maybe I'll do something else entirely, whatever the case may be. But I do believe the potential is there for Magic coverage to be so much different and so much bigger a couple of years from now that I can't discount that I'm going to be on the road 250 days a year traveling around a whole slew of events because the game is just something very different. Mm-hmm.
Is it also hard for you to answer that question, Patrick, because you have sort of fallen into most things that you've done?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's a big part of it. You know, again, if I thought about where I was going to be at 19, if you asked me where I'm going to be at 24, I would have told you, like, playing poker, on the pro tour, working at the store, in jail, up to some other shit. Like, it would have been something like that. And that's not the way that things played out. And some of it is random circumstance, and some of it is, you know, maximizing some of the opportunities that I got and being in the right place at the right time and all that kind of stuff. And so it does make it hard for me to give you a concrete answer, because 5 years from now I could be doing something totally random and we could be doing this podcast again and you could be asking me, well, how did you end up becoming, you know, the city planner for San Diego? And I said, well, you know, I was studying some architecture because it, you know, it interests me, or whatever the case may be. So it's hard. You are correct. It's hard for me to answer because, you know, who knows? Who the hell knows the way things have worked out so far?
Yeah. So my listeners submitted some questions. I put the call out there for things people wanted to ask you, and I've narrowed them down to about 5 or 6 questions, so hopefully you don't mind answering these. At Deadly Shoelaces wanted to know, what is your favorite card combo?
Okay, so I would have to say it still has to be – I'm sorry. This is such a hackneyed answer, but it's still Tiger Curd Ape.
Okay.
Because the first time I ever did that was like 1995 or 1996. And this feeling of, oh my God, look at what I just did. It's so silly, you know. But for me, that was the first time where I really felt like I had combined the two parts to make something larger than what it was. And it's so simple and it's so resonant. I mean, people are still stomping ground, curd aping in modern today, and even Tiger Curd Ape and Legacy still shows up from time to time. The Invitational I top eighted a couple of years ago, I was playing Tigers and Curd Apes. So the fact that was the first time where I really felt like I had put something together, even though it's so basic and so simple and so stupid, you know, mm-hmm. combined with sort of the timelessness of it, it's something that people are still doing 17 years later. That has to be the top of the list for me.
Yeah. At T2 Brew wants to know, have you ever thought about doing a more noob-friendly coverage stream like Dota 2?
I have. I've given that a lot of thought. It's tough. You know, sometimes I go back and I watch the Star City coverage, and I think to myself, we are assuming a lot of knowledge on the viewer's end, you know? Mm-hmm. We have Death and Taxes playing against Bug Delver up on the screen. What the hell does those two names even mean? You know, you have to already be pretty informed. And then we're talking about – sometimes we're shortcutting card names. You know, when we're talking about Mother of Runes, we're saying Mom, or we're saying Plow instead of Swords of Plowshares, or, you know, whatever the case
may be. I hope
you're
not using Mom and Plow in the same sentence.
Well, they do appear in the same deck. So sometimes sometimes it's unavoidable. It is the only deck that plays with Mother of Runes. So it's sort of – it's hard to avoid.
Okay.
But I don't think that Star City Games is the right platform for it, mm-hmm. because, you know, the brand of Star City Games, the website's very tournament focused. The content on the website assumes that you know a lot of knowledge about Magic already. It's for people who are, I'm at FNM, I want information, or I'm going to the next PTQ. And the coverage sort of reflects that. Mm-hmm. We assume a lot of knowledge. But I have thought about, is there a way to make a Magic stream or even a set of videos that could give some people some more rudimentary information. For example, I was watching the Pro Tour coverage a little while ago, and they went to the booster draft section, and, you know, it's like, all right, the booster draft's about to start, and we're going to watch William Jensen. And it's just Jensen with his pack in front of him, looking at some cards, with two commentators talking about the card that they're supposed to pick, what they think that he's going to pick or what he should pick or whatever. No explanation on what the hell booster draft is, or how this is different from playing regular constructed, or how many cards is his deck. I mean, again, the broadcast assumes a lot of information already known to the viewer. So could you come up with a set of videos to just be, you know, this is what Booster Draft is. This is what Constructed is. And this is what the format's all about. I know they do a little bit about that. But could it be a little bit more formalized? Could there be more of it? Could it be living on a website somewhere? I do think about that a lot. I don't think necessarily converting Star City's stream into something more new player friendly or having a competing stream with more of a new player angle. I don't know if that's necessarily appropriate, but I think there is a lot of room for education, and the coverage people, myself included, take a lot of, you know, pretty nuanced specific information for granted. And it's something we can definitely improve upon.
Sure. Sure. At S9865 or S wants to know, what is your favorite magic shop in New Jersey?
The only game in town in Somerville, New Jersey, the store that I used to work. I don't know if this is a target player, but it was originally in Hillsboro, and Hillsboro, New Jersey had all sorts of horrible hobby stores growing up. We had one that was just shut down because it was just not successful. We had another one where I believe the guy got run out of town because of a statutory rape charge. We had another hobby store that got shot down because it was a mob front. I mean, the list goes on and on of just like disastrous hobby stores we had in town. And the only game in town opened up, I think I was a sophomore in high school or junior, and it was right around the time that Urza Saga and Urza's Legacy came out. And I was on a hiatus from Magic at that point for about a year. So we had a good store. There were some new sets for me to look over, and that's what got me back into Magic. And in the absence of that store, I don't know if that would have ever happened. I think I would have just gone on, you know, doing other things with my time as a high schooler. So it was originally in Hillsboro, moved to a different location in Hillsboro, is now in Somerville, I believe at 211 West Main Street or 210 West Main Street. Anyhow, if you're in the Central Jersey area, you should check it out. The store is awesome. The players are great. Sandy, the owner, Frankie Sutherland, the head manager, really good people, and if you like playing Magic, competitive or casual, they kind of do it both ways. I suggest checking it out.
At Lissiv, L-S-V, I guess that's his name.
Oh, I love reading Twitter handles. It's my favorite part of the broadcast.
Right? I think he's somebody. He should probably work on that, though.
Congratulations to Krosis69 for your 3 free months of Star City Games premium content. Make sure you're following us. So we give that over to you. Yes. It's my favorite / least favorite part of the show by a lot.
I love when you guys do that personally, because I always I have to ask you though, has there ever been a time where somebody has won, but they have a very like embarrassing name or maybe a name you can't say on the coverage so you can't pick them?
That has never happened.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's because it's just randomly never happened.
Okay.
Or if the people on the sideline choosing the winner at random reject any dumbass names.
Okay.
I don't know. I've never asked.
Okay.
And if it ever comes up, I will definitely, you know, if we ever get an obscene name, if they ever hand it to me, I'm just going to say it. So we'll find out what happens when that comes up. If it comes up, we'll find out what happens then.
You're going to be at GP. The next open is in New Jersey, right?
Right.
Okay.
This weekend.
Right. So you're going to be on coverage this weekend. And I'm going to be watching like I usually do. And you're going to be like, okay, Dirty Panties 67. You've won. Like, I want to see your face when that happens.
Yeah. Your mom rules with a Z. Congratulations. Or whatever. I'm sure they can find out. If it's a Star City Games show, I'm sure not all the Twitter handles tweeting at us are above board. So.
Oh.
I'll see. Maybe I can grease the wheels and ask them to select the most obscene one and see what happens. We'll see. It's supposed to be a random drawing, but maybe we need to take some liberties to execute this experiment.
I would love that. So LSV, who we all know and love, he wants to know, what were the best and worst things about testing with Team Channel Fireball? Note, Conley is an acceptable answer to both.
So I worked with LSV and Paulo and Conley, the rest of the channel team, for the Return of Ravnica Block Pro Tour. The best thing about working with that group was there's this very good balance between people who are elite at building particular styles of decks or working on particular styles of decks. You know, LSV builds, he's an incredible control player and incredible at building those decks. Brian Kibler, it's hard to argue he's not the best deck builder on earth when it comes to mid-range green decks, and so on down the list. And I was able to kind of slot in very easily as, well, mono red looks like it's kind of a deck in block, and Patrick can focus on his attention on tuning that deck. And then you have some people like Eric Froelich or Josh Erlayton or Jerry Thompson when he was working with the team that are really good about being objective. Mm-hmm. They look at all the decks. They look at the results they're posting. They have very good ideas for recommending 58th and 59th and 60th cards. And that balance between specialists who are going to advocate for their thing and work as hard as they can, making their deck as good as possible, and the rationalists who are supposed to sort of guide the process, make sure that, you know, the testing's efficient and that, you know, the decks are getting improved in this incremental fashion. That was a great balancing act. That's what really stood out to me about that team. Mm-hmm. From a downside, I think that there's this element. I don't know if it's probably like this on every Magic team. Like, Lord knows it was like this on Target back in the day when I was playing. And there was elements of this on Channel 2 where, you know, people like to – it's not necessarily out of competition, but people like to come up with lists of, you know, what's your favorite song? What's your favorite CD? And sometimes the conversation wanders into who's the best drafter on the team or who's the best player on the team or – and then ranking down the line. And there's no way that that can walk away without someone's feelings getting hurt because someone has to end up at the bottom of the list of, like, the team's worst drafter or the team's worst constructed player. Mm-hmm. And no one ever was doing it out of malice, this kind of stuff. But I do believe sometimes there was a sort of a tin ear about, you know, everyone here is a sensitive human being and – maybe they don't like you having a conversation about whether or not you think they're – you two arguing passionately about is this person the second worst drafter on the team or the worst drafter on the team? You know, maybe that's not – I understand you're not doing it to be mean. You're not trying to bully this person. You are trying to just have a rational conversation. But maybe a little more sympathy to the person who you perceive to not be the best on the team is in order. That's a very minor thing, but it did crop up a couple of times where the conversations I was just like – We can't be talking about this about people when they're sitting right here. We shouldn't be having these conversations in general, probably, but certainly not when the people in question are literally in earshot.
Sure.
But a great group of people to work with. I would, you know, that's a very small thing in the scheme of things. And if I were to qualify ever again, I would work with those guys in a heartbeat, no question.
Sure. So last question I have for you is from my friend Frost. He wants to know, if you were to change your Twitter handle to another basic land, what would you change it to in order of preference?
I would go, so Mountain 1, Swamp 2,
Yay.
Island 3, Forest 4, Plains 5.
You don't like Plains? You're not a white player?
It's just, well, there's two things. One is, I think it sort of suffers in Magic because it's the part of the – I believe it's the color with the least definition in the color pie. Mm-hmm. Most of its mechanics are – its core mechanics are shared by other colors. So that's – it's always had a difficult time, I think, standing out in relation to the other colors. Mm-hmm. Also, I think Basic Planes is the least threatening opening in Constructed Magic. So there's that. And historically, decks that have opened on Basic Planes have kicked the shit out of the decks that I play. So there's – It's not defined, it's not good, and I lose to it constantly. So Plains has to be at the bottom of the list.
So I would imagine you and Craig Wesco are not the best of friends.
Well, you know, we actually, oddly enough, ended up working on – or he sort of cribbed my list for – I was working on Boros for Modern at Grand Prix Detroit last year. He read my article, improved the deck substantially in 3 days or whatever, and he had a – I don't know if he had a top 16 or a top 32 finish at the Grand Prix, but he did very well. So we've had that moment of, okay, we kind of share some – we're sharing a little bit together. But by and large, the decks that I like to play are really bad against the decks that Craig likes to build. They are really bad.
I think I scared him the one time that I met him. I was coming home from GP Richmond, and we were on the same flight home together. And I was sitting towards the back of the plane. I was sitting near the bathroom, and Craig had to use the bathroom. And somebody was already in there, so he was waiting. And I saw him walk up to the bathroom. And this is still – I was still at the point where I was really, really impressed by Magic personalities. And I still am, but not to the degree that I was at that time. So I see him walking towards me, and I'm like, that's Craig. That's Craig Wesco. Oh, my God, Craig Wesco. And I start waving like a lunatic. I'm like, Craig! And he looks over at me, and he's just like, hi. He just gives me this really small, demure little wave. And I'm like, oh, my God, Craig, I love you. Big fan of yours. And he's just like, I just really need to pee. And I kind of queened out on poor Craig Wesco a little bit. So, and then he went in, and then after he went out of the bathroom, he turned right to see if I was still there. And I was like, Craig! And I'm waving. And he's like, I'm going to go now. And, yeah, I'm pretty sure I scared him.
Craig kind of gets this weird rap where, you know, he's not the world's most outgoing guy by any stretch. Mm-hmm. But once you are kind of on the inside of his you know, Craig and I, from sort of an outward personality standpoint, we could not be more different dudes in a lot of respects. But now, we've known each other for a very long time. We've talked a lot. You know, we've hung out and stuff like that. And now it's the conversations with him are really natural. And he's a funny, outgoing dude mm-hmm. when he's in his kind of comfortable space. But it takes a little while to get there. And, you know, if I had to list ways to get to that side, you know, screaming at him as he's walking to the bathroom on an airplane, probably not near the top of the list. But once you kind of get on the inside of his comfort zone, he's a really warm, outgoing, funny, gregarious dude.
Yeah, I actually ran into him at GP Minneapolis, which was, of course, after that. And I was much more controlled and discreet. I was like, hello, Craig. And he was like, hello. And I don't know if he remembered that at all, but I did handle myself better the next time around.
He probably remembered.
He's like, who is this crazy folk waving at me on a plane? Yeah, I'm sure. But that's fine. I'm fine with my little milestones. You know, I understand that I accept that I will probably never be on the pro tour. But hey, I beat Aaron Forsythe at something. That's a milestone for me. I taught Paul Rietzel how to use Skype. That's a milestone for me. So I'm happy sort of claiming my little milestones and making them big deals. So that's
fine. I am the least tech savvy person on the planet of my age group, and I can use Skype. So I'm not sure what training actually has to go into this. And you never know. I'll tell you what, you never know about the Pro Tour. The PTQ I won was the most, it was totally random, ran hot an entire day and got to the finish line. And there's players out there that I've seen qualify where, you know, they just had a really good grasp on the format or it was just their day, whatever. If you keep plugging away at Modern and you have your day of catching the right matchups and running hot, all that stuff, you'd be surprised. I mean, the idea that the Pro Tour is this unachievable milestone, I would have told you the same thing 15 years ago, and it doesn't have to work out that way. You had to catch some breaks. I never won a PTQ or things weren't breaking well for me, but the idea that the Pro Tour is this entirely inaccessible thing for you is not true. It is not true.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, I do have a good deck now, quote unquote. So I do plan on spending the next 3 or 4 months getting good at it. And I have my ticket for GP Omaha, the first Modern GP of next year. So I'm ready to go. I plan on hitting it hard. So
good. Yeah, that's having a good deck, that's step one. Playing a bunch of games, that's step two. And then traveling to all these really expensive, huge tournaments in hopes of catching the breaks that you need, that's step three. So if you get the first two steps out of the way, and then the rest of it's just effort and opportunity.
Awesome.
That's how it goes.
Awesome. See, you're making me believe I can do it.
it's more attainable. You know, the trappings and the lights and sounds, the matches getting played on camera, the people that you see, whatever. All that stuff matters only as much as you allow it to. And whether it's, you know, you're trying to qualify for Pro Tours, it happens a lot with people when they're like playing on camera on SCGs, whatever the case may be. All the elements, the trappings, they're only as large as you allow them to be. You know, every match that you play can just be another match that you're playing at your kitchen table at your local store, even if it's at a Grand Prix or a Pro Tour or an SCG, whatever. You can just shut all that stuff out. That also takes practice, but getting hung up in the trappings is a way to doom yourself before the match even starts. Just push that stuff aside. Doesn't matter. Does not matter.
God, well, you've given me so much to think about, Patrick. Thank you. Thank you for the advice, and thank you so much again for coming on the show. And if anybody has enjoyed listening to you on the show, how can they find you? How can they get a hold of you?
I'm at Basic Mountain on Twitter. If you go to Churchill's, the bar in San Marcos, you'll see me there a fair bit. Those are the two most reliable ways to get at me. So, you know, Churchill's and San Marcos are at Basic Mountain on Twitter.
And they can also find you on StarCity.com on the stream.
Oh, yeah, sure. I guess that's probably more reliable than going to my local bar. Sure, yeah. StarCityGames.com, Twitch.tv/... No, whatever. You'll find me there. You know where to look.
I look forward to that meeting with the next Star City guys. We're like, you didn't even promote the website. You promoted the bar.
It was not the best plug, I'll tell you what. But this time, you know, this time is outside of my contract. So if they want to get upset with me, that's fine. But in the written word of the law here, I'm in the clear.
Well, thank you again for coming on the show. It has been a joy getting to know you. And I can't wait to see you at an open in the near future.
All right. Thank you so much for having me, and I will see you soon.
Absolutely. And if anybody's enjoyed what they've heard here on The Deck to Use, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is available on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can keep up with the show on Twitter at The Deck to Use. You can keep up with me at Original Estrus. And you can also email me personally at estrus@elitistjerks.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.